On the 20th of January 2017, Donald Trump took oath as the 45th president of the United States. Since then, his heterodox foreign policy has resulted in several contested decisions that were characterized by unpredictability and indecisiveness. Particularly, his policies in the Middle East have been controversial among the common people and in diplomatic circles. This episode will look more into Donald Trump's policies in the Middle East. Welcome to another episode of JSI Podcast. I'm Pradeep Krishna, an undergraduate student at the Jindal School of International Affairs. And with me, I have Professor Dr. Sriram Cholia, author and Dean of the Jindal School of International Affairs. So let me start by telling you what an honor it is to have you here with me.
Thank you, Pradeep.
Yes, sir. So the first point of discussion I want to bring forward is, of course, the most controversial decision taken by Trump in the Middle East, which was to unilaterally pull out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Relations with Iran worsened severely following the move, which eventually led to the assassination of General Soleimani. What do you think motivated the administration to make this move? And do you think there is any way for the new administration to negotiate a return to the agreement?
I think the Trump administration was driven primarily by a very Israel-centric approach to the region. So the whole idea was to isolate, marginalize, and to crush Iran in order to benefit Israel and to secure it and to establish its unrivaled dominance in the region. So the JCPOA was seen as integrating Iran into the Middle East security architecture. So, and Israel was very unhappy about it. So the moment Trump came into power, Israel worked very closely with Jared Kushner, who was Trump's son-in-law and Middle East so-called special envoy. And the whole game plan was to attack and to weaken Iran as much as possible. So the JCPO was seen as a hurdle because it bound the US and Iran in a cooperative format. And the whole idea was to break this cooperative dynamic and to create a conflicting dynamic where there would be pressure, where there was, the Trump administration called it maximum pressure. And the idea was to squeeze Iran. And so that was the whole politics behind it. And it served Israel's, or at least the hawkish elements in Israel, really well. And they were the ones directly coordinating and in many ways formulating the Trump administration's policy. So that's how it happened.
Okay, sir. And do you think there is any way for the new administration to negotiate a return to the agreement?
Yeah, I think Biden was involved in the JCPOA also when he was vice president under Obama. And the Democrats in the US in last decade or so, or even before that, have started to distance themselves from a kind of no questions asked approach to Israel. They have been more critical of Israel than before. And it's part of their domestic politics also. There are progressive American Jews who do not want to give a kind of a blank check to Israel to do whatever it likes, and who believe that some of the hardline policies of Israel actually harm Israel itself. So Biden is allied with those interests. And Biden will definitely attempt to reinstate the JCPOA. Although the assassinations you mentioned and those kind of very hardline clashes that have happened in the last 4 years have in many ways vitiated the atmosphere so much that it will take just one or two incidents, violent incidents, where Iran is implicated, and all this, you know, the attempt to reinstate this JCPO may go out of the window or be maybe further pushed back. Iran has also enriched uranium again and restarted its centrifuges and all that in the last couple of years as a retaliation to Trump's sanctions. So it will take a while, but I do expect that Biden will distance himself from the hawkish Israeli agenda and will attempt to show at least some kind of neutrality in the Iran-Israel tussle. And so I think you will see some movement on this after the Iranian elections in the middle of 2021. If there is not a return to a very hardline type of regime there, then Biden will probably open up and there will be renegotiations of some elements of the JCPOA and an attempt to reinstate it as a statement of the new kind of balanced, quote-unquote, or honest broker approach of the U.S. in the region that they want to bring back.
Okay, thank you for that, sir. So next, I wanted to discuss about the main conflicts in Middle East, the ones in Syria, Libya, and Yemen. How did Trump react to these conflicts? And can you throw more light on the decision taken by the administration in its last few days to designate the Houthi movement as a terrorist organization?
I think some of this is a spillover of the anti-Iran maximum pressure approach of Trump administration. So they saw the region from the lens of Hezbollah and the presence of Hezbollah, which is a very powerful group, not only in Lebanon, but they had also gone into Syria to fight on behalf of Bashar al-Assad. And the idea was that Trump himself was disinterested. He wanted to pull out. He didn't want any further intensification of the U.S. Involvement in the Syrian war. I think it was only seen from the point of view of Israel's security. That was the number one issue from the Washington's point of view. And the secondarily, they wanted a kind of a new balance of power in the region, which would put Iran on the back foot and would benefit Saudi Arabia and Israel. So that's where they were looking at all these conflicts from. So the designation of the Houthi as terrorists was done by Trump administration to further strengthen Saudi, which has been engaged in this war for more than 5 years now, and to try and sustain the anti-Iran momentum, because Saudi Arabia got involved in Yemen saying that it is to push back Iran. So just like Israel, Saudi's logic has been very similar. And the Trump administration believed that. So these are the two. I mean, Trump administration disappointed a lot of allies around the world, angered a lot of allies, alienated a lot of allies, US allies. But when it came to Israel and Saudi Arabia, they delivered on almost all their wishes. And I see the way they dealt with Syria and Yemen as part of this, even Libya. In Libya, actually, UAE was more involved than Saudi. But they're also, they made it like a proxy war. And they were favoring one faction or one or more factions in Libya. So I think there was no cohesive, broader strategy for American influence to be sustained there. It was all about Israel and Saudi and how we can give some goodies to our best friends, these two, and make them happy and deliver on their wishes. So that was the whole, sum of what they did in the Levant region.
Thank you, sir. So do you think Trump gave a free hand to countries like Saudi and UAE? And of course, how do you think the Biden administration would deal with these countries?
Yeah, that's obvious. I mean, Mohammed bin Salman especially got a lot of leeway from the Trump administration, both with the war crimes that Saudi was committing in Yemen through aerial bombardments, and also the shocking murder and dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey. All these incidents gave everyone the impression that Saudi could get away with murder, and not just murder, but mass murder, with the Trump administration's blessings. And in return, Trump was only looking for weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, because oil used to be, once upon a time, an important binding factor between the U.S.-Saudi alliance. Is no longer important because the U.S. is self-sufficient or in some cases, actually in some markets, it competes with Saudi Arabia to sell its own oil. So oil is out of the picture, it's no longer a factor. Weapons sales have shot up in importance, and that's where I think Trump gave them. And I think Biden is not so close to the defense industry and the defense manufacturers. Although liberals in the US have also wanted to promote American corporate profits and sales around the world, but I think they will not push as hard. And that's why I think the end to the US defense assistance to Saudi Arabia for the war in Yemen has been announced rather quickly, the moment Biden came to power, because they think that, one, it was immoral and illegal because of the Saudi abuses in Yemen, and two, this was just dragging on and on with no result. I mean, Saudi Arabia was taking maximum US military aid and assistance, but was not able to win the war. So I think it was like a quagmire. So that's why I think UAE and Saudi have now been pressurized to step back and end that war, because it's just a huge embarrassment for the US.
Okay, thank you for the answer, sir. So any discussion on Trump's foreign policy would be incomplete without discussing the Abraham Accords. Can you tell us more about the long-term implications of the deal and how and if it will, if the new administration will make any changes to it?
First things, I think Biden will not reverse them. I think that's something, it's a done deal. And if countries start recognizing Israel, Arab countries, it's not seen necessarily as a bad thing by the Biden administration. So Biden will be more critical of Israel's settlement policies in the West Bank and potentially of Israel's attempts to annex occupied territories and all those things. But when it comes to recognition, I don't think they're going to try to reverse it. In fact, they cannot even reverse the big change that Trump made, which was to shift the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So those will remain. Only thing that will happen is the Palestinian Authority will again be able to have a diplomatic presence in Washington, because the one that was shut down by Trump administration. So so it's an attempt to balance, but not so much that it will lead to a rupture in the basic U.S.-Israel alliance. It's more like a kind of a calibration. So I think the whole outlook now is Israel and these Arab countries will proceed with their rapprochement. And it's not necessarily a bad development, because it at least resolves one outstanding cleavage in the region, which was the so-called Arab-Israeli conflict. Is that sometimes, I mean, sometimes people subsume it as a part of the Palestinian issue, but now what has happened is the Palestinian issue has been kept aside, and the broader Arab-Israeli rapprochement is happening or has already happened. So I expect more Arab countries following the footsteps of UAE and Bahrain and Morocco, and I can't remember the other one, Sudan, that's recognized Israel. I expect many more to happen, although I think the US will try to make it more conditional now. In Trump's time, it was all about everybody should recognize Israel and we'll even pay you to recognize Israel. Now I think it's going to be more conditional, unless Israel restrains itself on some of its extreme actions, the US will not encourage more Arab countries to recognize Israel. But I think the overall dynamic is that fault line is being resolved, the Arab-Israeli one. But on the other hand, the other big fault line remains or is even getting worse, the Iran versus Israel fault line. So the Arab states may make peace with Israel, but Iran-Israel, Iran-Saudi, those fault lines remain very strong and quite dangerous, actually. And all it takes are some incidents, quote-unquote, that can spiral out of control and bring the region to potentially to a big war. So I think Biden will have crises and he will be really tested, because the even if he wants to moderate the climate in the Middle East, and he may wish to do so through the by restarting JCPOA and all that, it will not be taken kindly by a lot of the Arab states and by Israel. So they may plot their own actions to try and thwart this whole normalization process with Iran. So Arab-Israeli Abraham Accords are great, or in one way calming the waters and burying the hatchet. But on the other hand, it's kind of giving Israel a legitimacy to exist in that what used to be a very hostile neighborhood, it's less hostile for them. But then Iran and its allies will continue to challenge Israel. And so the likelihood of a regional war, which will drag in even the Arab countries, cannot be ruled out.
Thank you for that answer, sir. So the next I wanted to discuss about one of the most important event that happened in the Middle East during Trump's administration, which was the blockade imposed on Qatar by the GCC countries. How do you think this blockade affected ties between Qatar and the US, and what role did the US play in the resolution of the blockade?
Well, I think Trump was just flattered by Saudi Arabia way too much, and the kind of total one-sided approach that Trump took by supporting Saudi and opposing Qatar was quite unusual, because you know Qatar is also a US ally and it hosts one of the biggest US military bases in the region. So instead of being fair or equitable between the two allies, Trump decided to go with one ally against the other, and that really weakened the entire US alliance system in the region. And Qatar actually moved closer to Iran after this blockade. So the blockade did not succeed. One, because Qatar has got a lot of gas revenues and wealth. And two, even though it's small, it did not accede to any of the demands presented by Saudi and the other GCC members. They wanted Al Jazeera to be shut down. They wanted Qatar to close all linkages with Iran. They said that Qatar was sponsoring terrorism. So Qatar did not change its behavior. So in a way, it was like a defeat for Saudi and the other GCC members, because they could not achieve. And finally, you know, after years of this blockade, they realized that it was not going anywhere. And so they had to patch up and eventually say that, okay, now we are lifting the blockade. But what it showed was that the intra-Arab politics and bickering is very, very high. In some respects, it's as bad as the Israel-Iran, or as bad as the Iran-Saudi conflict, although they also maintain linkages in terms of the royal families and all these things. Many of these Gulf monarchies are quite suspicious and mistrustful of each other. So now they have patched up, because Qatar prevailed and could not be bullied. But you can't be sure. I mean, I think it's an artificial settlement, and you may expect more tensions to emerge again among the GCC members in the future. The difference, of course, this time is that Biden will not easily tilt the scales on one side or the other. He's going to play the old traditional role of being a neutral broker or an honest broker. If at all Saudi and Qatar again are at loggerheads, they cannot expect automatic support from Washington like Trump gave. So I think to that extent, it will moderate the tensions within the GCC members, but they have not gone away. And if there are major armed violent incidents, you can expect that again Saudi will blame Qatar, and again Qatar will try to hold its ground. I mean, this is like there's a deeper dynamic about dominance and subordination in the GCC that you know, it cannot be resolved just through a patch up like this. So it just shows that the region, sometimes people divide it along the ethnic groups. Like you have the Arabs, you have the Jewish, you have the Persians, and you have the Turks, right? But if you go deeper, among the Arabs, there are lots of differences and enmities. And sometimes it's also along sectarian lines. For example, Iraq is an Arab country, but it's a Shia majority Arab country. So it continues to have problems with the Sunni majority Arab countries. So the intra-Arab dynamic is quite complex and not a very stable situation.
Also, sir, do you think now that Qatar is close to Iran, can they play a role as a mediator if Biden wants to come back to the GCP like they did with Taliban in Afghanistan?
I think more than Qatar, Oman has been had played a role in the original JCPOA 2015. They played intermediary between between the US and Iran at the time. And there are some countries that have kind of are not exactly on one side or the other, but are fence sitters. Oman is one. So they could potentially come back again, or maybe they're already involved, we don't know, in public, behind the scenes, to try and do this rapprochement. So, and I think Qatar has learned the value of Iran during the blockade. So they're going to continue to maintain linkages with them. They share a big gas field in the Persian Gulf. So they're partners. I mean, you can't help it. I mean, even though Saudi hates it, Qatar cannot help it, but it will have a partnership with Iran. So, and ideologically also. So what I'm saying is, it's not like all the Arab states will gang up and fight Iran. That's not going to happen. And Iran has a lot of countries in the region like Syria and Iraq, Lebanon, Qatar, Oman. All these countries are not likely to side with Saudi in any kind of a massive pressure campaign against Iran. So they're somewhere in between. So that makes it a very divided and complex field.
Okay, so one more thing I wanted to discuss was that the tenure of Trump saw the rise of President Erdogan in Turkey. Turkey, like despite being a NATO ally, they moved closer to Russia and Iran. So can you tell us more about Trump's policies on Turkey and how effective it has been?
Well, I have a whole chapter in my book, Trump, about Turkey. And Erdogan actually benefited a lot from Trump because Trump wanted to pull out from Syria and from Iraq. And Trump was looking to withdraw US forces and leave it to Turkey. So Trump abandoned the Kurdish allies and pulled out of northern Syria, northern Iraq. And that made it easy for Erdogan to send the Turkish military across the border and occupy those places. The Turkish military is still there. It's more than 2-3 years now. They've been there saying it is to secure Turkey. So they've got it's like in this, a mini invasion of Syria and Iraq. Historically, you know, Turkey is the inheritor, the modern Turkish Republic is the inheritor of the Ottoman Empire that used to rule over most of these Arab countries. So there is this dimension of neo-Ottomanism of Erdogan, and Trump did not mind it. He didn't care because he thought if Turkey is going to fill the vacuum, if Turkey is going to fill the power gap being left by US withdrawal, so be it. That's good because it will give the US an alibi to withdraw from the region. So I think the overall outlook was looking good for Erdogan. And Erdogan, because despite his becoming more and more of a dictator and an authoritarian, Trump had no criticism whatsoever for him. I think all these things benefited him a lot. But now, I think with Biden in power, I think they're going to be more critical about Turkey as a NATO member, and that they're going to be insisting on more adherence to democratic norms and all these, which Erdogan has completely abandoned. So, like Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, like Netanyahu of Israel, I think Erdogan of Turkey will be under pressure to some extent due to the change in Washington. But end of the day, I mean, it's a NATO member and it's an ally of the US. And Erdogan is also quite wily. I mean, sometimes he sounds extremely anti-Western and anti-American rhetorically. But then if you look at the crux of his policies, he doesn't necessarily go against their interests all the time. So I think you have to see the nuances instead of simply looking at Turkey as a troublemaker or as a constructive player. Turkey is both in many ways in the region. But more, my fear is that Erdogan is almost 20 or more than 20 years in power now, almost 20 years. And he's just trying to hang on to power at all costs. So he's becoming more and more whimsical, unpredictable, and reckless in his conduct. So that's the real danger, because the sovereignty of Syria and of Iraq cannot be just bartered away to Turkey and to Turkish domination. So Turkey must withdraw from these regions. Turkey has been supporting ISIS and other groups for many years now. So Erdogan has played a very, very dangerous game. It was facilitated by Trump. But I think the Americans are going to do more tough talking now to him. But whether that will change the dynamic, we have to see, because Erdogan needs to do these dangerous things in the region in order to remain in power at home. So there's a link between the domestic political crisis that is building up against Erdogan and his totally illegal way of operating in the region. So I think it's not looking good, and I think Biden will face lots of difficulties handling Erdogan because he's now entrenched for a long time and he's unwilling to concede power to the democratic opposition in Turkey. So he will use militaristic and violent means to remain in power. And that's not good news for the region.
Okay. Yes, sir. So the last thing I wanted to discuss was that what would be the long-term effect of Trump's policies on the Middle East, and how much will it interfere with Biden's plans?
I think I think Trump administration really skewed the balance in favor of Israel. So that's the largest, the main takeaway. And in a way, Biden cannot reverse that, because as I said, once you recognize Jerusalem as a capital of Israel, then you cannot go back on it. I mean, no US government can do that. And likewise with the Abraham Accords. So these are like fait accompli now. They cannot be reversed. And so Trump's legacy will be, he will be remembered very fondly by leaders like Netanyahu, like Mohammed bin Salman, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. These people, these leaders gained a lot from the Trump period, and they're going to miss him. But on the other hand, Iran may have heaved a sigh of relief when Trump was defeated in the US election. So I think there's no question that Trump's legacy is to divide the region. He never really attempted to unify the region or to create a cooperative region as a whole. There was no such big grand strategy. It was all about who are my main allies, and I'll do everything for them unquestioningly or even go to any extent for them. So that kind of thing, I think it backfired in the sense like it could not maintain overall stability. And now, as I've been saying, the potential of regional war remains. So if that is so, then Trump contributed to that through his isolationism and transactionalism. So it's not something to be really proud of from a U.S. Grand strategy point of view, because what he has done is he has just made the region more volatile over 4 years. And now Biden, I doubt whether he can put the whole the genie out of the bottle. It's out. You know, the instability and the rivalries are much worse now than they were in 2016. So in that sense, the instability will remain, may probably get worse, and Biden may face some major crisis before the end of his term.
Okay, thank you so much, sir. I think that brings us to the end of the podcast. Thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thank you, Pradeep. Always proud of our students doing good work like this.
Thank you, sir.